Welcome to Friday. It is time for KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is the hour where we figure out what happened this week and what does it all mean. And we've got Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger, host of the podcast Trust Issues. We've got Knute Berger, the Mossback columnist for Crosscut and Seattle Magazine. We have Chris Vance. He works at the county assessor's office now. He's been a county councilman in King County. He's been a state representative. He's been the chair of the Washington State Republican Party. Still a Republican, Chris?
I refer you to the answer I gave last time I was here. Status unchanged.
All right. We'll have an interactive tracking tool on our website to see where Chris is on the Republican thing. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming.
You betcha.
Thanks for having us.
Number one, story number one. When I say state budget, do you lean forward or tune out? I hope you lean forward because this affects your schools, your taxes, your paid leave, your neighbors. Rich people, poor people, it's a $40 billion budget, 600 pages long, and we're just now finding out what was in it because legislators only had one day to vote on the whole thing to avoid a government shutdown. It was signed in the 11th hour, 11:23 or something before midnight. So we're going to go through it. We've been going through it this week, figuring out who wins and who loses. I asked Governor Jay Inslee yesterday on KUOW, is it fair that Seattle and Bellevue, Lake Washington, Mercer Island school districts will pay huge property tax increases to pay for schools in more rural school districts? How is that fair?
Well, I don't think it is. I think the Republican plan to raise the property taxes, this was their proposal. They were insistent on it. They threatened to shut down the government if they didn't get their way. And I don't think it was the right way to finance schools.
So we can blame the Republicans for being unfair, right, Chris?
Well, I think both sides had to vote for this, but I think the governor just flat out said it. People have been asking all week, how did this happen? The Democrats were just not willing to do a government shutdown, so they caved in to the only revenue proposal that Republicans would vote for.
What would have happened if they hadn't caved in?
I think there would have been a government shutdown. I mean, I've been saying it for years. There was zero chance that the Republican Senate was ever, ever, ever going to vote for any kind of tax increase other than the revenue, than what's called the levy swap, the property tax plan that they proposed.
And does that make them savvy?
Oh, absolutely. Because yeah. if they could have gone home to their voters, their base, and said, we were willing to shut down government to stop those evil Democrats from raising your taxes.
Yeah.
And instead, they got a big tax increase on, guess what, the most Democratic parts of the state.
Sydney, are the Democrats weak-kneed, lily-livered, what do you call it, account? No account chickens?
Well, they definitely...
I need to brush up on my caricature, my cowboy...
insults
my
here.
My cowboy stereotypes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't even vote on the capital gains proposal that would have been in their budget anyway. So I'm disappointed in the Democrats. And it's clear that the Senate Republicans hold a disproportionate amount of power. And as associate editor at The Stranger, Eli Sanders has pointed out, what we got is a budget that has perpetuated the welfare state for rural Republicans paid for by urban Democrats.
But isn't that where the property is rich? You want to tax the rich, right? Shouldn't we tax the property rich Puget Sound area school districts to pay for, because those other districts, the rural districts, they still got to build schools and pay teachers and stuff, but it's more expensive to do.
That's true, but this is also the same state legislature and the same Republican Party that is giving away hundreds of millions of dollars to Boeing and TransAlta to transition a coal plant. Like, the Republican Party in Washington State is willing to do corporate welfare and tax individual homeowners in Seattle just because of this vindictiveness against Seattle that it's in the state. So it's completely illogical and it's childish. Frankly,
Knute, do you think that that's vindictiveness on the Republicans' part to tax Puget Sound area school district?
Well, it's certainly not bad politics in terms of local politics, because Republicans in particular like to kind of foment hate of Seattle around the state. I'm not as upset. I don't mind the wealthy areas subsidizing education or other things in the other areas that are less prosperous. And having people all over the state educated better and well is to everyone's advantage. It's certainly to the city's advantage because a lot of those rural kids will get a good education and then they'll come to the city and get a job.
So they get educated, they won't want to live where they live?
It is in our own self-interest to have a really great public education system. And I wasn't looking for perfection in how this would happen. I hope that, you know, bipartisanship can fix whatever problems are in this thing once people read it and actually figure out the numbers and see, you know, how well it works. And it's certainly far from perfect. I mean, you know, I agree with Eli and have for years about tax reform in this state. But, you know, the property tax is a little more progressive than other taxes. Now,
because if you have property, then you're paying. If you don't,
if it's worth a lot, you pay more, you know, but it's less regressive than, say, a sales tax. But a question for Chris: isn't the education package includes revenues from a new tax on internet sales? Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and
so the Republicans did vote for a new tax.
Yes, but they voted. They've always been willing to vote for a tax increase if the business being taxed will agree to it. They did that before a couple of years ago, I think, on real estate or I can't remember exactly what it was. And both on the family leave bill and on the internet tax, the Washington business community, I think, sort of signed off on that. So,
why would they do that?
You'd have to ask them, but because they thought a lot of businesses are hurt. A lot of brick and mortar type businesses are hurt by the fact that my wife does all of our shopping online now. I mean, and so some businesses are willing to support that. But the idea that they would ever vote for an income tax or a capital gains or just a big across the board increase in the sales tax was never going to happen. And the Democrats blinked first, and that's how we got this. But just, you know, we do need a major overhaul of how we do taxation and service delivery in this state. But two quick points. First of all, the idea of the levy swap, which is what this is, you know, you lower local levies and you raise the state levy. That first came from a Democrat, Ross Hunter, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee when he was in the House. It's been a bipartisan idea that many people have supported. And the other thing is, we need to disabuse ourselves of this idea that schools are supposed to be funded locally. Our Constitution says that's not the case. If you go buy a car here in Seattle this afternoon, the money goes to pay for services in Walla Walla and Spokane with the sales tax.
We need more local control, right, Republican?
No, we don't. No. Don't need more local control. The words local control do not exist in the Washington State Constitution. What the Constitution says is the legislature shall provide a uniform, statewide funded, controlled statewide system of public education. That's what the McCleary case is always about.
Okay.
One thing to add. So, Chris, I'm all for a robust, well-funded public education system, even subsidized by richer areas of the state. But
not subsidized. That's how we do taxation in Washington State.
Or by richer areas of the state. But what happens here is when SPS officials actually looked at this, when the Seattle Public Schools officials looked at this, they said that there's going to be a $44 million gap because of their inability to use local levies because of this, because of the state budget. So it actually, when we're talking about equity, not just equality, we're talking about equity. Seattle Schools, biggest school district in the state, has a lot of its own needs to fulfill, and because of this, we can't get there.
Then they should go back and talk to the folks who in 1889 wrote the Washington State Constitution.
We can make that happen.
This is what the McCleary case has been about, and what people have failed to accept or recognize is paying for schools with local levies is blatantly, clearly unconstitutional and wrong because it leads to rich school districts and poor school districts.
So would you support a capital gains tax?
We're not talking about that. We're talking about
alternate sources of revenue to fund McCleary.
No.
She asked you a direct question.
No, she asked me about whether or not it's okay that Seattle can't raise taxes locally. And the answer is no, they can't. Kids in Seattle—
I'm going to put you down as a yes on capital gains tax.
Kids in Seattle should not get a better education than kids in Washtenaw.
I'm not arguing that. I just asked you if you would propose an alternate source of revenue to fund our unconstitutionally underfunded school system.
If I were ever back in the legislature, I would support a complete look at everything about how we fund and provide services in this state. But okay. I don't anticipate being in the legislature again anytime soon.
How come?
Been there, done that.
Been there, done that? Do it again? No?
Talk to my wife. I don't think she'll let me do it.
Okay. Anything else before we move on about the state budget? We have this manufacturing tax cut that actually any second the governor might veto. He's getting some heat from Democrats saying, this is a giveaway, another tax cut, not just Boeing, now it's more manufacturers.
Yeah, and I found it interesting that at least half of the Democrats who are signing this letter saying veto it voted for the bill. Uh-huh. The key thing here is, and I don't know the answer to this, is if this was part of the negotiated deal, if the governor agreed ahead of time that this was part of the package to get the session done, and then he turns around and vetoes it, no one will ever talk to him again.
I asked him about that. I don't have it on tape right in front of me, but I said, is that fair? And he said, yeah, it's a separate bill, and this is how it works, and this is divided. I'm the executive, and they're the legislature.
He promised to support this and then vetoes it, no one's ever going to negotiate with him again, and they shouldn't, because once a deal's a deal.
Okay. Anything else about the legislative session, the budget we've reached, Knut?
No, I mean, I don't really have anything to add. The question that comes next is who's going to control the legislature.
Yeah, that's good.
Of course, we have the 45th district. We have a race there, swing district. And I think that's one of the ramifications of the education, the McCleary deal, is what is the impact going to be on swing districts? A lot of these swing areas are seeing those huge tax increases, but
hundreds of dollars a year.
But Mercer Island and Lake Washington School District, Bellevue, these are places where education is often listed as the number one priority of parents. So it'd be really interesting to see how that plays out. The Democrats obviously want to pick up a swing district, and they want to pick them up in the future. So it'll be interesting to see how.
The other big thing is whether or not the Supreme Court. I don't believe the new McCleary plan they passed. It is by far the most serious, comprehensive attempt at satisfying the McCleary decision so far. And I spent 8 years working at the Superintendent of Public Instruction's office working on this issue. But I don't think they did it because it continues to allow school districts to pay basic education staff with levy dollars. They call it enrichment, but a teacher or a paraeducator teaching a kid to read, that's basic education. And they continue to allow levies to be used to fund those positions. I think that's clearly unconstitutional, but does the court have the backbone to again say, no, legislature, you did not fulfill your paramount duty? I don't know. We'll find out.
Which, again, begs the question of how you fulfill your paramount duty, which mm-hmm. I think that you, Chris, are saying if you were in the legislature and with your Republican brethren, you'd find new efficiencies or something like
that.
Okay. Well, how are we going to fund public education? Is if it's not capital gains, if it's not property tax, if it's not local levies, where do we go? Is it a state income tax? I mean, Governor Jay Inslee said he wouldn't support that either. So it looks to me like the Democrats and the Republicans aren't willing to actually answer this question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right. And, okay. and if I were running for the legislature, I would have to answer that question.
Carbon tax, right, Chris?
If I were actually a candidate for state office, you know, you need to.
If you were a radio guest? Would you have to answer the question?
I think that the state needs to sit down and have serious bipartisan discussions about all these issues. Our current tax system doesn't work.
Okay. Pause there. The Olympia State Capitol building is almost within range of a North Korean ICBM. We'll talk about North Korean threats. We'll talk about the Ballard Locks. How should you feel when you go to the Ballard Locks to watch the fishies swim? That and more, cheering on the soccer sidelines versus shh on the Week in Review. With Knut Berger and Sydney Brownstone and Chris Vance, I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW, and we're figuring out what happened this week. For one thing, North Korea proved it can reach Alaska with a missile. And by longstanding treaty, an attack on Alaska is considered an attack on the United States. Technically, under Article 5, the U.S. would be obligated to defend Alaska. Well, a lot of people don't know that.
Well, you never know. I mean, Donald Trump just met with Vladimir Putin. He might have given Alaska back.
Best friends.
It's disturbing to hear. You know, we heard some foreign policy and national security analysts say a few months ago that Seattle will soon be in range. And Seattle kind of makes sense as a target theoretically because there are a lot of people here. We have a lot of naval bases and tech giants and stuff. The thing is, we were already wrapped up in North Korea, have been for a long time. I talked to this expert, Kent Boydston, this week, who said the North could already hit South Korea or Japan, where we have American troops.
So if they were attacked, we would have to get involved, and we would surely be involved. But when it's capabilities to strike the U.S. mainland, somehow that's a more of a psychological threat even that, oh, the North Koreans could have a missile that could actually strike somewhere like San Francisco or Seattle.
Yeah, that feels like more of a psychological threat to me because I'm not in the Army and now we live within missile striking range. Did anybody lose sleep over this? Any reaction to our little dance with North Korea?
I didn't lose sleep over it immediately because they're years away. First, you have to build a weapon that can actually re-enter the atmosphere without blowing up, which is difficult. You have to build a warhead that you can miniaturize and put on an ICBM, which is difficult. But the point is, the North Koreans are deadly serious about this, and we are going to wake up one morning, if we don't do anything about it, where they have the ability to launch a nuclear weapon that will hit Seattle. And that is unacceptable. And that's not a radical idea. Every American president has said nuclear-armed North Korea is unacceptable. Unacceptable is a word that means you'll go to war to prevent it. This is very...
Do they really mean it? When they say unacceptable, do they mean...
They don't mean it.
Do they mean acceptable?
If they don't mean it, they shouldn't say it. I mean, the United States cannot tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea. And eventually, either this president or the next one is going to face a very difficult choice, I think, of either going to war or allowing North Korea to have nuclear weapons, because they seem determined to reach that point.
The only thing that scares me more than North Korea having nuclear weapons is President Trump making a decision regarding North Korea's nuclear weapons. Like, I can't lose sleep over it because I feel like if we were struck, there's absolutely nothing I could possibly do about it. I would kind of just let the winds take my radioactive particles away. But another point.
That's a beautiful image, though. It's lovely.
Yeah, it is rather poetic. But the other thing that what this makes me think about is, North Korea is kind of like the perfect enemy for Donald Trump to have at the moment. He's like the perfect caricature of a foreign villain. And I that him gaining power around that idea, even more power, is scary to me. And the other thing that I think we should think about now that we're on the subject of nuclear disarmament is the Hanford disaster that is in our backyard, and Trump's dismantling of the EPA, which oversees Hanford. I think that's a disaster that's more likely in the short-term future than a threat from nuclear from North Korea.
Well, I want to hear from Knut, regarding North Korea, it does sound like President Trump is on this.
As far as North Korea is concerned, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I don't like to talk about what I have planned, but I have some pretty severe things that we're thinking about. That doesn't mean we're going to do them.
Okay. He's thinking about severe things, and that doesn't mean he's going to do it. So, is there any other problems we can solve today?
Well, that is kind of the North Korean conundrum. I had a whole different perspective on this after visiting the demilitarized zone up there a few years ago.
I visited too. Tell me
about
it.
You've been there too.
Yeah,
so you know. And when you drive out of Seoul, you see the barbed wire and watchtowers along the river, and they have these big, they look like overpasses on the freeway, but they're actually anti-tank barriers. So that when the North Koreans invade, they can blow them up and block freeway access. Mm-hmm. And then you get up there and it's, landmines and soldiers, and it's bizarro land too. I mean,
and a giant nature preserve at the same time.
Giant nature preserve. And then there's all kinds of artificial things there. There's a place we went to had a little fairground with rides. People could go up there, but they also had a fake train station that the South Koreans had built.
Where they have a carnival. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, you go in this train station, and it's a train station for the day when you can take the train again from Pyongyang to South Korea. But
it's like a Harry Potter train station. It doesn't.
Exactly.
There's no real train.
You get a fake passport stamp. I mean, it's totally bizarre. But what you realize is, North and South Korea never ended the war.
Yeah,
it's an armistice. They are still in ready mode. And if North Korea really wanted to screw everything up, it might be terribly self-destructive. But they could just nuke Seoul.
Did you see
and
the
it would
security guards
change the world?
Did you see the guards who stand with one foot, one eye looking down on the other side of the border, and they stand in this physical sort of battle ready position at all times.
Yeah, it's these
weird
young
vibe.
Guys. It's very. Yeah, very strange. I'm a Cold War kid, so I'm used to the idea that the Soviets were going to lob nukes at any moment. You know, I don't think anybody's living in that kind of terror. But what is interesting is that they've said they were going to do this for years, and slowly they are actually doing it, regardless of all the sanctions. And and you understand rationally why they are doing it.
No, you don't. But
you do, because if you're a nuclear power, you have leverage, and they want leverage.
Just ask Muammar Gaddafi.
And not only that, the North Koreans are working on submarine-launched ballistic missiles. They're testing that, and that is even more frightening, of course, because that's a first strike capability. You can't see the submarines coming across, and they could. If you have submarine-launched missiles, the range is much shorter on the missile. You can threaten the West Coast. Sanctions don't work against North Korea because they get 90% of their trade from China. And every American president for decades has begged China to do something about North Korea. And the Chinese have no interest in doing that because crippling sanctions on North Korea causes their economy to collapse. And that's the last thing China wants, is for North Korea to collapse. Eventually, the United States is going to have to decide whether they mean it when they say that we enforce the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and that we can't live with a nuclear North Korea. The Japanese and the South Koreans can't live with that. I mean, an intermediate range ballistic missile.
They have lived with it for a long
time.
No,
they haven't, because they don't have nuclear weapons yet.
They will. Okay.
That's exactly right. I mean, Tokyo.
Yeah, but they could still lose a lot of lives. It's been going on. There's been 65 years of peace.
But having a nuclear weapon changes everything. Imagine being the Japanese prime minister and understanding that you'd have about 5 minutes before a North Korean nuke hits Tokyo. You can't live with that. So this is as dangerous as it comes. And I'm very worried about it. It's not funny. People should be very worried.
I just hope that the United States doesn't make that decision unilaterally, because I don't know how you enforce the non-proliferation treaty when you've lost all respect from the other nations of the world. But we'll see.
Did you say there was a fairground there?
Yeah, the part of the DMZ we visited had a little, like a little carnival.
A carnival. Like
with a Ferris wheel and a merry-go-round and that kind of thing. And people would.
That's David Lynch-esque.
Oh, it's very Lynchian.
I like the idea of a carnival game where people step up and try to solve the North Korea conundrum, but no one ever wins that game. You know, they never win the Cupid doll. You always think you can do it. Every president steps up. Ready to win that stuffy. Never happens. Okay, KUW's Week in Review, continuing with what we should make of the Ballard locks 100 years on, and if Seattle school zone speeding signs are complex, does that mean you get to ignore them? Coming up. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Sydney Brownstone, Chris Vance, and Knute Berger. This is the Week in Review. Did I say that? We're on Twitter at KUOW. This week, the Ballard locks turned a century old. To some people, the locks and the whole ship canal from Puget Sound to Lake Washington are a crime against indigenous people. But other people are going to a parade this weekend. Sorry, Knute.
Thank you.
Celebrate. Well, that's what this is. I mean, this is an engineering triumph. This is the digging of this canal and locks robbed people of their way of life. Tell us about this parade that's happening this weekend on the occasion, would you, Knute?
Well, so the 100th anniversary, the ship canal and the locks are probably the single most transformative, terraforming project that Seattle ever undertook. Linda Mapes had a wonderful story in the Seattle Times about its impact on the Salish people and the landscape, the salmon, the environment. One of the guys who runs the locks today said, yeah, no way this would get built in 2017.
Why not?
It was environmentally devastating. I mean, it destroyed salmon runs. It basically eliminated an entire river.
Yeah.
It dropped the level of the lake many feet, created a lot of waterfront. But It was devastating. And of course, many of the native peoples who were still subsisting on salmon and other on the lake shores and who still lived on the lake shores were forcibly removed or simply, you know, saw their livelihood disappear, their ability. Yep. And you know, they'd been there for 10,000 years. So,
yeah. So it's livelihood and a sacred relationship and just got drained.
So there is that. And I think it's really important that we look at that aspect of the history. On the other hand, there is the sort of the settler view, the pioneer view, the engineer view. I mean, Seattle, the terrible history of what happened to Native peoples is not just reflected in the ship canal. And there was a lot of what we take for granted in modern Seattle came about because of the ship canal. It opened up shipbuilding and being able to have fleets that wintered over in fresh water. The whole reason we're the home of the Alaska fishing fleets is because they could come here for repair and be here during the winter seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of industry, in terms of real estate development, in terms of transportation.
And fun.
You know, most of the people who use the ship canal today are recreational.
That's right, like 80%.
And we built a system of bridges that opens and stops traffic to let one guy in a sailboat go through.
Right, hallelujah.
So, I mean, the ship canal is a defining feature of Seattle. So it took them a long time to build it, right? They were talking about it in the 1850s, and it wasn't completed till 1917. So Seattle process, you know, it was 60 years of lawsuits and arguing about where it ought to be and all this kind of stuff. But here it is. And so people are celebrating. There's a new book out. There's going to be a parade of historic boats through the canal. My sister and brother-in-law own a cool old wooden boat, so we're all going on it in turn of the century costume.
It's a recreation, right, of when that schooner and other boats first came
exactly.
through.
It's kind of a recreation of the first trip through. So that's on Sunday.
What are you wearing? I'm
excited
for that?
About that. I should just let social media surprise social media, but I will, if any old timers are listening, I will look a little bit like Tiny Freeman, if that means anything to you.
Nope.
Look it up. Google Tiny Freeman and you'll get an idea.
Sydney, when you bring your out of town friend or your kids or your nieces and nephews to the fish ladder and have them watch the fishies swim, are you teaching them an appreciation of the natural world or showing or enjoying the torturing of the natural world?
Well, I don't have kids or nieces or nephews, but I did bring a Tinder date to the Ballard Locks once.
Yeah? How'd that go?
He was not into it. I was like, oh, look, the salmon are so cool. And he just was not interested in it at all. So to that end, I guess I was complicit in, the continuing colonization of indigenous lands. But
and turning it into a date.
Yeah, no.
So it's only fitting that it didn't work, that you swiped left or whatever the not working out means.
Yeah, I did not swipe right again. Right. But Knut was right in calling out or shouting out Linda V. Mape's piece. I thought it was excellent in diving into the history. She also cites this academic named Cole Thrush. And Cole is an excellent researcher on the indigeneity of cities like Seattle. He's doing a book on London next. He has a book called Native Seattle that digs into the history of what happened when the lake was lowered. And it really just dried up, you know, the Black River. And it depends, like, Knut was saying, it depends on your perspective, right? If you're looking at this from an engineering or settler perspective, this enabled a lot of things. But if you are, for example, a descendant of the Duwamish tribe, which is still federally unrecognized, that ship canal has a lot to do with the reason why the tribe is not federally recognized to this day, meaning that they don't get several of the federal privileges and rights associated with federally recognized tribes. So
what does the ship canal have to do with that?
Well, so when the lake was lowered, it dispersed several of the people who had been living on the banks of the Black River. Mm-hmm. And in order for a tribe to be federally recognized, they have to demonstrate continuity of leadership. So while some people who were dispersed went over to the Muckleshoot tribe, some just, you know, became urban Indians. And there was no continuity of leadership for 4 years, I think, between 1912 and 1916. So because of, well, that's just one of the conditions you need to become a federally recognized tribe, but because of that dispersal, they were disqualified from attaining federal recognition this last go around.
What do you think about all of this, Chris?
What do I think
about Ballard Locks? What's the lesson?
Well, I don't know if it's true in the rest of America, because I've only lived here. I've lived here my whole life. Everywhere you look in the Puget Sound region, there are massive engineering efforts that completely changed our geography. I live maybe a mile from the Green River. The Green River at one time was a wild river. Then we built the Howard Hanson Dam and a huge network of dikes and levees and pump stations, so the Green River never floods. And because of that, you have modern Auburn, Kent, Tukwila, and Renton, which is one of the world's largest distribution centers of warehouses, all the commerce that comes out. I don't know anybody who would want to argue that we want to again have debilitating floods in the Green River Valley, but I'm sure it had a huge impact on the Native Americans who lived there. Seattle, as it exists today, doesn't look anything like it did in the 1840s or 50s. The seawall, the regrading of all the streets, the Ballard Locks. We came to this area and we rebuilt it. And I think that it's, I don't know how it,
I detect pride in your voice.
Well, it's inevitable, and it could not have been avoided. I don't see how. And today our values have changed. I think it is true. I don't think you could have built the dams on the Columbia and Snake River, which created modern Washington State, then we'd be lost without them. We'd have more coal fire power plants probably because of it. But today would we
be lost? I mean,
yes.
It would be a different.
Oh,
yes. It would be just different.
Well, it'd be very different. And today's values would not have allowed some of these major projects, but they are what created modern Washington State.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse.
I mean, what's the name? Tiny Freeman. I'm going to Google
Freeman.
That.
Hey, okay. Ran for mayor.
Oh.
There's a hint. Pioneer Square. Yeah, check it out.
Was the beard and mustache similar?
You'll have to look at
that. Okay. Linda Mapes, she did a terrific piece in the Seattle Times, which you can find. And speaking of Googling, and also I talked to Linda, and Sydney's bringing up. Are you bringing up
this Tiny Freeman? It's like this guy wearing a bowler hat and holding a bottle of alcohol. Is this the guy?
Yeah, there he is. Curly hair, bowler hat, glasses.
Same guy.
Yeah. That's when our mayoral elections were really interesting.
This is like a time travel.
They were fun.
You don't think this one's interesting right now?
Oh, it's interesting. It's just not fun.
I think we should tweet. Could we tweet out a picture of Tiny Freeman?
I'll do that.
Oh, thanks. And I had a lovely conversation with Linda Mapes, which is you can find at our website as well, on this issue, 100 years of the Ballard Locks. And we had a commemoration on 4th of July. We had fighter jets flying over because a Boeing biplane circled that original opening ceremony.
And one more thing about this is they're old and they're degrading and they need about $41 million of repairs. And our congressional delegation needs to make sure that happens, because if the locks ever failed, then you'd have, Lake Washington draining partially into the Puget Sound. The lake would catastrophically lower. The floating bridges would be in trouble. So
how about that light rail train that's going to be coming over the floating bridges? That's
so
cool, right?
Whether you like them or not, we need to make sure they continue to work. And so the congressional delegation needs to get that federal dollars to maintain them.
This just reminded me of a childhood fantasy, because my dad was born right before the locks opened a couple of years before, and had this infant, childhood memory of the lake being higher. And he probably imagined it.
Uh-huh.
But he used to tell me about it, and so when I was a kid, I used to want them to drain the whole lake. I wanted to see
what's on the bottom.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been good for the floating bridge. There was only one then, but
you know what?
What is down there?
Actually, I know something about what's down there, because we have a local wonder reporting project.
Right, you did a thing on that.
Yeah, and so I'll save that for your surprise as well.
And just there you go.
I grew up on Lake Taps, which is a lake that does drain every year.
Yeah,
it's not pretty, it
smells
bad.
Good
and
though,
it
right?
Smells bad.
I just imagine like a bunch of used tampon applicators down there.
All righty. That's an excellent guess.
Public radio.
Well, you'll have to read the article. Can we tweet that too, Kara? Yeah, our social media producer, Kara, is working hard.
We're busy.
To tweet every idea we come up with here on the Week in Review. So join us on Twitter at KOW and stay tuned because we're going to talk about what happens on the sidelines of a youth soccer game. And actually, I want to connect that to this moment of silence on the sideline. That could be applied in so many ways beyond youth soccer. And also complex speeding signs in Seattle. What to do? Oh, they're so bewildering. What could we possibly do about it? You'll find out coming up. KUOW's Week in Review. Knut, what are you seeing on your phone?
Oh, so somebody just retweeted the Tiny Freeman tweet. Says, who wants to be in at Knut Berger's wooden boat party? It's a very small boat, yeah.
That boat's going to be headed through the Ballard Locks this weekend, in case you missed that discussion, a century of the Ballard Locks. Knut Berger is the Mossback, a columnist for Crosscut. He writes for Seattle Magazine. So if you see him, you're going to think, hey, what's Tiny Freeman doing here? But it's Knut Berger. And Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger, and her podcast is called Trust Issues. And Chris Vance has not only been a King County councilman, a state representative, a chair of the Washington Republican Party, he has been the president of the Auburn Youth Soccer Association.
I was for okay. 2 years, yes.
I want to know how you feel about this, Chris, because this story is controversial. I'm warning to listeners, I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but a South Carolina youth soccer league has forbidden all cheering on the sidelines for a month because parents there were abusing their cheering privileges. They boo, they scold, they harass the referees. Youth referees harassed. Mm-hmm. So this league official in South Carolina says this season is going to begin with Silent September.
All of this allows a reset to, you know, what kind of positive cheering should we be expecting? What things are best interpreted by our youth players? What's best for the kids?
Positive cheering. And it's not just South Carolina, as you can guess. Cheering restrictions are a live issue in Seattle area soccer leagues. We take you live now to the Starfire Sports Fields in Tukwila, where my colleague, reporter David Hyde, is at his 10-year-old son's soccer tournament. Hello, David.
Hey, Bill.
First of all, what is the cheering / booing situation there right now as we speak?
Mostly cheering. Our club, Seattle United, they are really specific about that. Nothing other than cheering allowed. I've even seen, you know, coaches call parents out for it during games. And Alex's team is up 1-0, so we've been hearing cheering from our side.
That's your son. His team is up 1-0. Please keep us updated. What happens with Seattle United? What happens if a parent does something other than cheer?
Prison. No, I don't know. I don't know what happens, but you're not supposed to do it.
Okay, because it's never happened, obviously.
No, it happens. You know, they get called out during games. The coaches will say, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, stop whatever you're doing. Stop coaching your son.
Wow. And that's not awkward for anyone on the pitch. Okay, well, how harsh have you found Seattle area soccer parents to be in their haranguing? What's your experience?
You know, it ranges. Sometimes when we go over the east side, I don't know what it's like for Chris down in Auburn, but, you know, you hear some pretty angry parents, and the worst is kind of when they're yelling at their own kids. I talked to one of the dads here who told me that he thinks that this silence rule would be kind of difficult thing for him to follow. He'd have a hard time not cheering or coaching a little bit. But he also said that he could understand why they're doing it.
Worst thing I've ever seen is parents yelling, kill her, against my daughter's team. And another parent was threatening a 13-year-old girl, also on my daughter's team. Wait till you get off the field and you see what happens.
I find that all hard to believe.
Do you, I don't.
Really?
Oh, no, not even close.
Kill her?
Absolutely.
That's a misheard. No. That can't be.
No, I've seen parents ejected from Starfire, which is where David is. We've had to call law enforcement. We've had disputes between clubs. Your parents are terrible. No, your parents are terrible. We're not going to come play you anymore. It's not funny. People take this way too seriously.
Okay, our live correspondent David Hyde is in Tukwila. David, update. What? Ooh. What?
Sorry, they just scored another game.
Who? Alex's team?
Yes. Up 2-0 now.
That's 2-0. Did Alex? How
2-0,
many?
Exactly.
How many goals has your son scored?
Zero.
Zero. You gonna let him? Is that okay with you? You gonna let him have it?
I don't think so. Okay.
Who are you playing, David?
I don't know the name of this other club. We'll be honest. They're wearing blue. We're wearing Sounders green. They're pretty good, but not good enough apparently.
And whose parents are superior? Who's more obnoxious? Your tribe.
In terms of willingness to coach from the sidelines, I'm not hearing any coaching from the sidelines today. It's pretty good.
Nice. Well, that's nice. That's nice. Okay, how much time left in the game?
Oh, another 40 minutes.
40 minutes. Okay, keep your vocal cords warm, and you have some work to do. David Hyde, thank you so much for this.
All right, thanks, Bill.
David Hyde is Seattle United is his son's league, and he's in Tukwila at the Starfire sports fields, a tournament going on there. So, you know, we have another expert here, our social media producer, Kara McDermott. Kara, you're not just David is a soccer parent. Chris has been president of the Youth Association. Tell us about your soccer bona fides, please.
Oh, well, my resume includes I grew up playing soccer in the Puget Sound region. I was also one of those poor youth referees.
Oh.
And I have coached youth soccer, and I have seen and heard things I cannot see or unhear.
Now, are we exaggerating? I feel like Chris is shaking his head, we're not exaggerating. I have just coached a little bit, a couple, like, coached in quotes, because this is like a six-year-old kind of thing. And so I'm out there and
they're teaching you.
They're teaching me, exactly. But I haven't seen this level of animosity. About what age are we talking about? Do youth referees start getting abused?
Well, let's see. I started refereeing when I was around like 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
And a bunch of gals on my team and I went and did the referee training, went out and refereed, you know, youth games for like a year. And
yeah.
So you're doing 6-, 7-, 8-year-olds, a few years younger than yourselves. The next year, I was the only one who came back. There was like a 90% attrition rate because the abuse was so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to report a parent once. And
there's a shortage of referees because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I'll tell you exactly why. You know how we've all kind of accepted the idea that if you want your kid to be an Olympic gymnast or ice skater, you need to turn them over to a professional coaching academy when they're like 5 years old. Well, that's now the situation with team sports. Soccer particularly, but also volleyball, basketball, and girls softball. And these are not parents coaching. These are professional coaches. These parents are paying thousands of dollars a year for their kid to play year-round in leagues that they travel statewide. They go to tournaments out of state. It's all designed to get your kid a college scholarship, and it starts younger and younger. When I left the association, we were starting our academy in the first grade level. And this is not rec. This is, people are deadly serious, and these parents think that this is their kid's future. And they take it unbelievably seriously, and kids get hurt, kids burn out. I caution parents now, be careful before you have your kid try out, because you have to make the team, because you're getting into a world that is intensely competitive.
So, yeah. So, Canute, what do you think of Silent September, a month where... it's happening in South Carolina. Could happen here. You have to just be silent and watch the game.
Well, I'm used to that because I'm a Mariners fan. You know, but I mean, when they actually...
The funereal atmosphere is familiar.
Usually happens around the 7th, 8th inning, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of ridiculous to put, you know, a gag or... straitjackets on people. I mean, there's clearly a problem, but it's with the adults. It's,
yeah,
you know, as Chris is talking about, I mean, these people probably are, you know, not uniquely abusive on the field. It's probably something that happens in the car on the way to the game, or, you know, and that kind of thing. It's really sad. It's one of the aspects. It's not so much the parents, but I remember I was a gym flake. You know, I didn't want anything to do with PE or mm-hmm. coaches, and you know, and even when I was a kid, it was because the guys who ran everything were angry dads, you know, and I had one of those at home. You know, I didn't want to go out and have some stranger angry dad bossing me around. I'm not saying that, you know, all the people in youth soccer are like that, but it's that same syndrome of people who take something way too seriously. In my generation, the dads were all guys who'd been buck privates in World War II and had gotten screamed at in basic training and wanted to take it out on their sons.
So I think a month of enforced silence for all those reasons is a fantastic thing. It's not going to last your whole life, but it's a little reset. What do you think, Sydney?
Argue with me.
I'm obviously right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, personally, I'm a fan of boomers being silenced for a month, so it's fine with me. But no, I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't do sports, but I did pre-professional ballet training for quite a long time. And so we didn't have angry dads, but we had angry dance moms. And oh, my God.
Angry about what? It's ballet. It's not even competitive.
Do you want your kid to get into the Pennsylvania State Ballet Company?
Bingo. Then,
yeah.
So you yell at the ballet referee?
There are no ballet referees.
Yeah.
But
who are you yelling at?
Back in, you yell at the teachers. You yell at the dance company directors.
Why isn't my kid front and center? Why are they in the back row?
Yeah. And then you insert yourself into all the really important roles for each performance. Like, oh, I'll sew the costumes. And that way I can, you know, tell this kid who's my kid's rival that she's fat. You know, it's so
insane. Really?
It's so bad. But I mean, back to my earlier comment about boomers being silent. The only reason I say this is because millennials, people of my generation, are constantly told that we are too strident and care about silly things.
Yeah.
So I'd like to turn the tables on that one and say, look at yourselves, soccer moms. Look at yourselves in the mirror. Look real hard.
Well, wait a minute. I'm 55 years old. I'm at the end of the boomer generation. These parents now are millennials. Or whatever Generation Xers, or whatever you call them. I mean, they're parents in their 30s now.
Now it's a generation. See how quickly we rise to the generation rivalries.
And she nailed it. It's not they want to win that game. It's they think their kid. And the biggest issue is playing time. Why isn't my kid playing? Why are they on the bench? And it's because they want to be. There are literally college and high school coaches out there at these games scouting, and they want their kid noticed so they can get the scholarship to go play. You know. And so then they get ideas of money in their head. And like I said, no, it is vicious out there.
It also seems like a profound narcissism, right? Because if it's not about the kid, who is it about? It's about the parent who's
exactly.
Not a soccer star.
Exactly. No. But that is most I'm a loudmouth, so it's about me too. But most of our arguing and opinionating is really just our own little identity drama that's in our head. So I think an enforced month of silence, you could say that about you know, anything. Just be forced to be silent. I went to a silent party one time. I actually did. People sitting around not speaking. My friend.
Mimes?
It was basically a mime party.
Mime's birthday.
Was this a paid meditation retreat? Is that?
It was unpaid, but it was a social meditation. Anyway, yeah. It's like life in general. The game will go on without your opinion. Yeah. Okay, let's get to our last topic, which is a story in the Seattle Times that got me and my friends arguing as well. The city of Seattle ticketed a driver for speeding, and the guy fought the ticket because he said Seattle's school zone signs are too complicated. And have you all seen this sign, this photo in the Times? From top to bottom, there is a flashing light, then a yellow sign that says school in big letters, then in giant letters, speed limit 20. Then in small letters, it says when children are present. And then under that, it says, or when flashing. And then there's another light. And then it says under that, photo enforced. And all of this was too confusing for driver Jason Canfield, who was forced, therefore, to go 28 miles an hour because he was so bewildered. He triggered the speeding camera, got a $234 ticket in West Seattle. He spent $800 in filing fees and record gathering, photocopies, transcription fees to prove that the signs violated state laws about clarity and simplicity, and he won. Seattle will have to simplify its signs. And Canfield says this was not about wriggling out of a fine.
The money never factored into it. It actually cost me a lot more than the ticket itself to fight it. The whole point is to keep the kids who are going to that school safe. You need to give drivers warning in advance. They need to know, hey, you're entering into a school zone. Here's a big old sign that tells you, you know, you need to slow down before you get your first ticket.
The big sign clearly says speed limit 20, but he beat the ticket. Now, my friends look at this and see a victimized everyman battling bureaucracy. I see a lead foot scofflaw using legal technicalities to make us pay for his recklessness. So please settle this.
Well, I got one of those tickets once because the deal here is the normal speed limit where I got the ticket was 35 and I was going 33 or something and I didn't see any kids and it was like 8 in the morning and kids are all over. But it was a time when they said when children are present during school hours. And so what happens then is the speed limit is lowered from its normal, for like 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And so the camera got me, and it is kind of confusing. When is it children present? When is it? The law is good. It's intended to just get people to slow down when kids are entering and leaving schools. But it can be confusing as to exactly when it's applied.
All right. Who's with me? You see 20 miles per hour. If it's that confusing, slow down. If you're that curious, slow down or stop while you read the sign. But to barrel through and then say, oh, I tried to read it all, but I was baffled.
I find it hard to sympathize with an everyman who spends $800 to resolve a $234 parking ticket.
Thank you.
It seems like this guy had something to prove against bureaucracy, so that's what he did.
Well, I think there's an interesting point being made. And I, like Chris, I got dinged on one of those, too. I'm much more careful now, which is why the $234 fine is there.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to have that ever happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's not about the children.
But I, like Chris, I was on ML King. I was in, a 30, 35-mile-an-hour zone. I didn't see any kids. The light wasn't flashing, but I got dinged. It didn't occur to me to complain about it. I just said, okay, my bad, And
that's all I'm saying. You got a speeding ticket.
But here's the point I think that's being brought up is we didn't used to have so many conditional signs. So, for example, the ones I found confusing initially were the ones where there's a big stop sign with an arrow pointing to a crosswalk.
Uh-huh.
And basically it means you have to stop if someone's in the crosswalk, right? Which is already the law.
Right.
But they made a special sign. But stop signs are supposed to be unconditional. In other words, when you see a stop sign, you're supposed to stop.
Yeah.
So there's a slippery slope thing going on here, I think, where they're making, this sign is only in effect,
Knut, I'm putting a stop sign up.
Yes.
Because it's the end of the hour.
Additional.
Yield. It's Knut Berger from Crosscut and Seattle Magazine and Sydney Brownstone from The Stranger and the podcast Trust Issues. And Chris Vance, great to see you all again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Soccer update, Seattle United now up 3-0 over the Seattle Eagles in Tukwila.